He's going to make the face. He's going to make the face.
I'm ready for my close-up.
I hate men.
What's going on, fellow passengers? So great to have you with us on Rearview Movies for our special Best Picture series. Got my usual co-pilots with here, Heather and Trevor, and we're getting ready to discuss a movie from 1950. We're a little past 20 years, aren't we, guys?
A little bit.
Just a smidge, yeah.
How old was everybody in 1950?
Let's see. Negative 34.
Were your parents around in 1950?
I don't think so.
No, my mom was not born until 54 and my dad was not born until 56. So there you go.
My dad was I won't spoil his age here for him, even though he's not listening. But no, he would have been around for this one, but he would not have seen it. So
So for those of you who can read the title, you know that our episode is about the amazing film, frankly, All About Eve, released October 27th of 1950. And Trevor, not really fully understanding the rating system, usually under IMDb where this rates films, it just put past.
Past, yeah.
So what was that about?
Okay, so back in the day when everybody was a little bit more prudish about what they would watch on movies and stuff like that, the studios kind of had this code that they made all their movies by, that everybody had to follow all the instructions by. It was called the Hays Code, and it listed out what you could and could not do in movies, and that can be a whole episode we could talk about because there's some really interesting stuff on there. You couldn't show people sleeping in the same bed, even if they were married.
Right.
So that wasn't a thing at all. A lot of people think that you couldn't discuss homosexuality in movies at that time, but the Hays Code did not specifically address that. What they addressed was what they called, like, I think they called it sexual perversions, which in those days, that's what they kind of viewed homosexuality as.
Right.
You could also not depict any interracial couple, period. That was like a huge no-no, right? So what they would do is they would make these movies and they would send them to this board to look at it. And if you checked off all the boxes on the Hays Code, then your movie was considered to have passed.
Huh.
And you see all that stuff. If it says it passed, it was good. It wasn't until probably the 60s when they kind of started to push the boundaries of it and really sort of see how far they could get on squeezing stuff by. One really famous note on that was Psycho, Alfred Hitchcock, the bathroom scene in particular. So you don't see her at all. All you see is like her lower legs and like her shoulders up, but she's clearly taking a shower. She's clearly naked in there. And so that would have been something that, had that movie been made 10 years earlier, they would have balked at that and been like, no, you have to take that out. We're not passing this movie with that in there at all.
Yeah.
Another one, they said that was the first time you ever heard a toilet flush in a movie. yeah. So that was another item in there, but they really kind of started to push that. And the people that were sort of the police of all this, there was always a president of that group, and the last president on there was not quite as conservative and strict to the Hays Code as his predecessors were. So things started to get through that hadn't gotten through before, and then finally they were just like, let's just get people to make whatever they want to make. And they found the Hays Code to be really restrictive to artistic expression.
Sure.
So they got rid of it and in place brought out a rating system that was three ratings. It was G, M, and X, and those were your ratings for a time. And then they thought that the range was still too broad on those a little bit, so
sure,
they did away with M, which was for mature. They did away with that, and they just threw in one for restricted access, so that's your R. So G, R, and X, and then they added the PG in there to be kind of a buffer between not so completely family friendly,
yeah,
but not to the point where we can totally restrict people from coming in. And then in the mid 80s, they added the PG-13 to kind of give a gap between PG and R, because there was a lot of stuff that was coming out there. Like, you know, in the 70s, Jaws was rated PG.
Yep.
You know, because it wasn't quite to that R level.
But yeah.
Maybe it shouldn't have been PG, you know. The one that really set it off was Temple of Doom in the 80s, once that came out. And that was the effort to get something in between R and PG was really brought into play by Spielberg at that point. So doing this from memory, I think the first PG-13 movie may have been Red Dawn, I think is what stands out. I might be wrong. I probably am wrong, but I'm wrong on a lot of things. But yeah, that didn't emerge until the 80s. And then they, you know, they did away with X-rated movies, replaced it with NC-17 when X was hijacked by the porn industry. You know, you have your X-rated movies and then you have your triple X-rated movies.
Oh, gosh.
Once that happened, they were like, well, we can't have X associated with our stuff anymore. We have to come up with something different, NC-17. Mm-hmm. And you rarely see that one even today. There's still movies that come around, but commercial theaters won't show NC-17 movies.
Mm-hmm.
So they either go independent, and at that point you're going to lose money. So
yeah.
Only a couple movies have ever been given the go-ahead to actually screen in commercial theaters before. Most notable would be Showgirls.
Yep.
In 1995, I think that was one in there too. But yeah, most times movies will get hit with that rating and then they'll go back to the editing room and tweak whatever they need to tweak. Well, we talked about it with Kill Bill. They had to clip that scene into black and white to keep from getting an NC-17 rating.
With all the fake blood.
All the fake blood, yeah. So it's in black and white. I guess we don't know it's blood. We're stupid, huh?
Yeah. Well, I will give you a partial score on the PG-13. So I do see one source that says Red Dawn is such the film that was the first one to be given PG-13. Another site says The Flamingo Kid was the first movie to get a PG-13. And that was in July of 84, which ironically for our timeline would have been the month after Karate Kid came out, which is what we just talked about.
Yeah, which wouldn't be right because Temple of Doom was 84. And that was the one that really, because people took their kids to see it because they went and saw Raiders, you know, three years earlier. And Raiders wasn't all that bad at PG, and they go see this, and the movie's pretty horrifying, it seems.
It does appear that Red Dawn is getting more of the mentions on that.
Yeah, I think
so. I do believe you were actually, you should give yourself more credit. You were actually correct.
Yeah, how about that?
So Trevor, what's some of the tale of the tape about All About Eve and frankly, the kind of loaded cast?
Yeah, it's a loaded cast and it's a loaded pedigree. So I guess real quick, what we're doing here is we're going to go through all the Best Picture winners.
Yep.
In random order, you guys are going to call out a random number between 1 and 95. And after March this year, we'll bump that up to 1 to 96 because we'll have another movie on that list at that point. And we'll go through as many as we can. And maybe not every month or, you know, but we'll do it when we can. And
we've already seen number 96.
Yeah,
Sorry to point that out. We've already seen number 96.
So you hope.
I'm a believer.
Yeah. Watch Barbie win it. Anyway, yeah, so we're going to go through all these. They're going to call one out at the end of this episode, and it's going to be completely random. No idea what it is. When we started this one, Heather called out 23. So this is the 23rd annual Academy Awards, which were held in 1951 for the movies that came out in 1950. So that would be this Best Picture winner here is All About Eve. And All About Eve is written and directed by Joseph L. Mankiewicz, whose brother is Herman Mankiewicz, who was recently the subject of a biopic on Netflix a couple years ago, Mank.
Hmm.
Herman Mankiewicz is the one that co-wrote Citizen Kane with Orson Welles back in the 40s. So this is his brother, Joseph L. Mankiewicz. And he wrote the movie, and it was based on an article that was called The Wisdom of Eve. And not an article, it was like a short story that was published in a magazine or something. Called The Wisdom of Eve by Mary Orr. And Mary Orr was not given any credit in this movie at all for being the person from where the source material came from.
Huh.
She was later added. So I think when you watch the movie now, her name's on the credits. But in 1950, when it first came out, her name wasn't on there at all.
So Mankiewicz basically jacked the story, wrote the script, and did not credit Mary Orr the first time.
Not really. Yikes. But it can't all be on him, too. I mean, this is also Fox is the one that's doing it.
Yeah.
So, a loaded cast here, as you said. This movie stars the legendary Bette Davis in one of her finest roles of all time. Bette Davis, Ann Baxter, George Sanders, Celeste Holm, Gary Merrill, Hugh Marlowe, Gregory Ratliff, Barbara Bates, Marilyn Monroe in one of her very early roles
mm-hmm.
in her career, and Thelma Ritter. And then, of course, since you always love the music, Alfred Newman. And yeah, that is the same Newman family that we find other musicians of that sort. So again, this is going to sound really low for numbers, but our budget for this movie was estimated to be $1.4 million, which seems very minuscule compared to the $350 million that we had Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny this year. this past year.
Good God.
$1.4 million. But as of...
$1.4 million. That's lunch on that set.
Yeah, exactly. That's one day of craft services.
That's right.
$1.4 million, which today would be about $17.5 million. So okay. even then, still a modestly budgeted movie.
Sure.
And then it had numerous runs. So the number that we found on here for the total gross is $8.4 million. And that came from numerous screenings over the years.
Yeah.
So of course they earned back their budget, but $8.4 million in 1950 translates to $104.7 today. So a very big success.
Cha-ching.
Yeah, for real. this is the most nominated movie in history at the Academy Awards. It set a record amount of nominations at 14. That record has since been tied twice. 1997, Titanic nominated for 14, and then 2016, La La Land, also nominated for 14 awards. Hmm. Here it wins 6 awards. It wins for Best Director for Joseph L. Mankiewicz, who this was his second year in a row winning Best Director. He'd won it the prior year. It's the second time that happened. It happened already in the 40s with John Ford, who won in back-to-back years.
Mm-hmm.
Mankiewicz is the second. And then we had it a third time happen more recently. Alejandro González Iñárritu wins back-to-back awards for Birdman and The Revenant in 14 and 15. So Mankiewicz, 2 in a row for him for Best Director. George Sanders wins Best Supporting Actor. Mankiewicz also wins for Best Screenplay. It wins for Costume Design, but this was at a time in the Oscars when they were awarding, movies were starting to come into color at this time. So they had separate categories for color and for black and white. So this wins Costume Design for black and white. And then there would have been another award for Costume Design for color. And then it also wins Best Sound Recording. It was also nominated for, but did not win. Bette Davis was nominated for Best Actress, as was Anne Baxter, and they lost to Judy Holliday for a movie called Born Yesterday. Bette Davis even would go on to say that she felt that she probably didn't win because the voters maybe split votes between her and Anne Baxter, which is kind of
imitating art.
Yeah, kind of ironic given the how the movie actually plays out. So
yep.
So neither of them won. We had the same thing for supporting actress. We had two nominated there. Celeste Holm and Thelma Ritter were nominated for supporting actress. They lost to Josephine Hull for Harvey. And then we were also nominated here for Best Art Direction and Set Decoration. Now today that category is called Best Production Design. That was also a black and white category. Best Cinematography in black and white, Best Film Editing, and what they call Best Scoring for a Dramatic or Comedy Picture, which is just now called Best Original Score. Some more superlatives. This appears on, we talked last time about the 100 Years, 100 Movies series that AFI used to do back in the late 90s and early 2000s. This movie appears on 4 of their lists. It was on the 100 Years, 100 Films for, it was number 16 on that list. Eve Harrington appears as the number 23 villain of all time on AFI's 100 Villains list, or I guess 50 Villains list. This appears on the 100 Years, 100 Quotes for Bette Davis's extremely famous and highly quotable line, "Fasten your seatbelts, it's going to be a bumpy night." That was number 9 of all time. And then they did a 10th anniversary list later, and this appeared on that list. It slipped a little bit. It fell to number 28.
Hmm.
This is also listed as the 5th best screenplay of all time by the Writers Guild of America. This also appears on the British Sight and Sound magazine. This is a very big poll that happens every 10 years where critics from around the globe are polled on the greatest movies of all time. It's a really, really, really highbrow list. So this actually appears on that list at number 211, and it's tied with a bunch of other movies at 211. It's tied with Raiders of the Lost Ark, Pink Flamingos, which is John Waters, and it's terrible. were either of you a part of that group that went and saw that in school? It was a midnight movie at the student center.
No, I missed that one.
Everybody walked out after about 10 minutes. And the people that were out in the lobby that were like working there, they were like, "Oh, wow, you guys lasted longer than last night."
Oh, that's funny. Wow.
We could write a screenplay about a guy who likes to drag his buddies to see films only to have them walk out, make it like a comedic film.
Yeah. Well, the difference there is I walked out of that one too, because I thought it was trash as well. But apparently it's good enough for Sight and Sound's 211. So Raiders, Pink Flamingos, also tied for 211 on that list is Twin Peaks, Fire Walk With Me, Melancholia, which is terrific, Brief Encounter, The Deer Hunter, which is a Best Picture winner, which will be on our list if you guys call that one year out.
Mm-hmm.
Duck Soup, also fantastic. Hmm. And the one of the great Italian horror films of all time, Suspiria. And then getting on to Rotten Tomatoes, critics score is 99, about as high as we'll DLC. Audience score is 94. The consensus line there says it's smart, sophisticated, and devastatingly funny. All About Eve is a Hollywood classic that only improves with age. And then I know you have some nuggets from Roger Ebert later, but I'll add that in his, obviously he was not, I don't think he was born in 1950, so he wouldn't have gone to see this at the theater.
Definitely not. No.
I don't think he started writing in film criticism until 1967, but he does have a book out called Great Movies, and this movie appears in that book where he says that Bette Davis's role of Margot Channing is her greatest role ever. So a lot of showering of praise on this one, which is going to be a common thread amongst all these movies, because while we will run into some stinkers in our journey through Best Picture winners, most of them are going to have this kind of, you know, critical celebration to it.
Yeah. So yeah, highly, highly rewarded. I would say with good reason. So many awards for the film, lots of good things to go into and to start with. So Heather, what would we start with in talking about our watch of All About Eve, which for a spoiler alert is not a Rearview Movies viewing. This would be our first viewing of All About Eve. It was negative 34 when this film came out.
Start with this though, when you talk about what you thought of it. Because I think that our audience of four probably doesn't know what this is. So kind of let's start with a brief overview of what it's actually about.
Sure, sure. Heather, can you give us a summary overview of All About Eve?
Sure.
Shoot from the hip on it.
Okay, All About Eve is a movie about a girl who is at the theater every night to go and see this play, to go see Margot Channing in this incredible play. And she gets invited backstage by one of Margot's best friends, who's always back there to see her. So she's like, come on back here and let's go see her. This girl creates this elaborate story about her background and who she is and where she came from. And everyone back there is just so taken by her. And it's, you know, it's Margot and some of her friends and her boyfriend. And everyone's like, man, what an amazing girl. She's just so awesome. Mm-hmm. And so they kind of take her in, and Margot herself takes her in and lets her move into the guest house and at her house. And she immediately, like, Eve starts working for her, and they kind of have this like honeymoon period of like, man, she's doing everything for me. I don't have to lift a finger. And she is on top of it. Like, she's just an excellent worker. And so it turns out that she's quite a bit conniving, and she ends up developing all these friendships and getting people to trust her, and convinces Margot's best friend Karen to let her be Margot's understudy for this play. And Karen, you know, Eve might be the conniving little girl here, but Karen was almost just as bad, if you ask me, in some ways, because Karen was like, yeah, I'll get you to be her understudy, and because her husband was the one directing the play. So she becomes the understudy. Margot somehow coincidentally misses the play one night, can't get back in time, and so Eve gets to perform. And she is able to call all these news outlets and gets, you know, everyone from the paper to come, and they write all these amazing articles about how amazing this understudy was this night in the play. And she befriends a newspaper columnist named Addison DeWitt. And Addison is quite clever himself, and he is the one that does some digging and finds out that Eve is not exactly who she claims to be. Does that pretty much get us where we need to be?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
If you're sitting there going, I've seen this story 1,000 times. Yeah. Guess where it came from? Right here. That's what I love about
the story
going back
of the obsessed fan, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I love going back at these like really old movies is, you know, you see things that you kind of take for granted when you're watching movies now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe a camera trick or something that was revolutionary at the time, and like today, it's just, yeah. I mean, who knows? You know, like we're not going to get to Citizen Kane, since that's actually surprisingly and shockingly not one of these 95 movies. But I mean, there was a lot in that movie in 1941 that nobody had ever seen before.
Yeah.
I mean, he shot the ceiling for the first time. Nobody had ever done that. He shot all four walls in the room. Nobody had ever done that. It was always on a stage. Three walls. Camera was the fourth wall. You never saw it was behind the camera. Depth of field in the cameras and stuff like that. I mean, there's a scene where Orson Welles is standing next to this giant window, and he looks tiny next to it, and then he walks towards the table, and all of a sudden he's huge. And it's like, you see that in movies all the time, these trickeries, or not even that, you know, just like just depths of field and or shallow depths of focus or whatever. And it's like, you don't think about where that came from. And somebody had to be the first one to kind of come up with that. So if we're going through these movies and it sounds like, oh God, I've seen that a thousand times, like, you know, the obsessed fan or whatever. And, you know, it all kind of started from somewhere. And someone had to do it first. And, you know, maybe this wasn't the first time, but I mean, this is certainly a really popular one. And there's been a number of TV shows and movies that have kind of paid homage to this storyline before. I mean, you could even like, there's a Family Guy episode that's like this. I mean, it's more one of the more recent ones, but still it's in there, and it's very much pointing back to this movie for sure.
Yeah. Right. If I was going to say the thing about this movie that makes it stand out pretty much immediately, it's two words: the writing.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh my God. Writing's phenomenal.
Oh, it's almost embarrassing, because I was thinking to myself, okay, for the first, this is probably the second or third oldest movie I've ever seen. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, so what's it going to look like? How's it going to feel? You know, nobody obviously makes this movie in 1950. Well, somebody in 2023 is going to be sitting on a couch watching it on streaming. What's it going to look like to them? The writing, the dialogue, beautiful, smart, sharp, so fast. I cannot say enough good things about it, and delivered so well, right, by all of the cast.
Well, and that's, you know, fifth greatest screenplay of all time, like we said. I mean, there's a reason why these movies are as highly regarded as they are, and you see them like that, and it's just, yeah, it's crazy.
Well, it almost makes you kind of laugh, right? Because a movie that we previously reviewed, part of the writing is there's a scene that hinges on people yelling bullshit at each other.
Yeah, right? That's true.
And that's a romantic comedy that's well regarded for this era. And, you know, and then you've got Bette Davis and Gary Merrill making jokes about Our American Cousin that are legitimately funny.
Yeah,
it's true.
It's just, I don't know. Not to trash movies nowadays in terms of their writing and dialogue, but it's just, I was really surprised at how smart this was.
Yeah, this is, it's like when people say they don't make movies like this anymore, they don't make them like they used to. I mean, really, it's true to some extent. They really don't make them like this anymore. That kind of, you're not going to get a laugh from people with dialogue this sharp if you were to write it today and put it in today's modern audience. Not to say that modern audiences are stupid. I mean, maybe I am, but it's very, very sharp, and it's very, very smart.
Yeah, it actually reminded me of two shows that I watch, Gilmore Girls and The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which were both written by Amy Sherman-Palladino. And if you watch those shows, the dialogue is extremely fast. And if you, I mean, there's tons of references. And if you get distracted for 15 seconds, you're going to miss three different references in the conversation.
You really got to pay attention to it. And that kind of is, you got to pay attention to stuff like this. And you have to pay attention to movies in general from this era too, because they're not structured the same way. They're not shot the same way. They're not presented the same way. The stories don't have all the, I mean, we went through the beat sheet a couple months ago. While those beats are there, they don't, you know, they're not quite as obvious and in the same spots as they all are. You know, people were able to pick up on that stuff as movies started to more progress. And then everything now is kind of just, it all kind of feels the same because they all follow that same paradigm. But back then, it was all about the dialogue. Most of these people, you know, they came from theater. So a lot of this stuff is really written and filmed and edited like it is on a stage instead of in a movie, which is where people like Orson Welles come in the 40s. And he's like, why am I restricted to just doing it like this? Why can't I do it this way? I mean, we have cameras, we have sets, we can do this stuff. And actually, you know, and that movie was 1941, and it was still years before anybody really kind of adapted to that method of filming, because this was 1950 and it still looks nothing like what Citizen and Kane looks like and what movies look like today is with everything, you know, filmed a little bit differently, and it doesn't seem quite as restricted. I guess that might be the best word I'm looking for. They seem to restrict everything by only building three walls, never showing the ceiling really, and just keeping the camera locked in basically one spot.
This is kind of funny. I was looking at some of the details. There is one modern film, I say modern, it's about 12 years old now, that is apparently listed as kind of a reworking of All About Eve's plot.
Huh. Interesting.
Any guesses?
I think I've seen this before, so I don't want to spoil it.
Okay. Heather, what do we think? You're probably the one most likely to get this right.
Okay. Oh, man.
Why don't you describe the plot to this movie to her without revealing any names and sure. See if she gets it.
Yeah. Someone who is very ambitious about finding success in a show business type field gets a very big break filling in for a star who's not there, and then rises to glory quite ruthlessly at the expense of others.
Drawing a blank, it looks like you are. Let's fill you in on what the show business field is. It's the business of male strippers.
Oh my gosh.
Does it dawn on you now? Like, holy shit, this is Magic Mike.
Yeah, Magic Mike is essentially supposed to be reworking of the script. Yeah, his character is basically Eve.
That's hilarious. Wow.
Which is funny because when you look up All About Eve's references in popular cultures, so many TV shows, like, because it's the kind of plot you can do really quickly in one episodic TV show. He mentioned the Family Guy. There's a Simpsons reference, Gossip Girl, the L Word, Glee, Will and Grace, Political Animals, Gilligan's Island actually has it happen. Somebody comes on the island, somehow comes on this stranded island and takes over Ginger's role.
That's awesome.
Can't get into that. Designing Women, the Dick Van Dyke Show did an episode about it. There was a 2009 comedy called All About Steve, which probably was, I would guess, the same thing.
And there was a 1999 Spanish film by Pedro Almodovar called All About My Mother, which there's some similarities in there. It's not entirely the same thing, but it's pretty similar. That's a really good movie too, by the way.
Yes. Huh. So performances, right? Which performance would you say like is the best first one to talk about? Obviously, Betty Davis is probably first in front.
Hands down.
Yeah.
And she should have won for this. There's no question. Hers is one of the greatest performances that's ever been put to film. That's in this movie, just period.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought she was incredible.
But then, I mean, you can't talk about All About Eve without talking about Eve. And that's, you know, Anne Baxter is also really pretty incredible in this too.
What about Anne Baxter's eyes?
Oh, yeah.
That was the big for me was, you know, she's got this, she's somehow capable of doing this very naive, very wide-eyed, very taken in kind of look where she's just so obsessed with the people in front of her. And then in a heartbeat, she cuts her eyes and it's like, oh, there's somebody in there that's working.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's,
you really pick that up when she's telling her story at the beginning of the movie too, because it's like everyone's captivated by it, but at the same time, and maybe this is just because I don't really remember the first time I saw this one, but you know, going into it, you know, she's this movie's villain and you can just see it in her face. Like she's just, it's this really well-rehearsed story that she's given probably to who knows how many people.
Yeah. And several mirrors.
Yeah. And several mirrors. Yeah. She's really playing it and she's performing it. She's given this huge performance of a lifetime right there. So, but I mean, and maybe Betty Davis is probably a little bit more legendary, but Anne Baxter is really well-known and well-regarded in her own right too. Mm-hmm. And by this time, she'd already won an Oscar as well. So, I mean, she had won a few years earlier for a movie called The Razor's Edge. But Betty Davis is, you know, when you talk about stars of Hollywood, dang, she's right up there.
Absolutely. And George Sanders' performance, Gary Merrill's performance. Although we have to say the women kind of dominate this film. Not just Betty Davis, not just Anne Baxter, but Thelma Ritter's Birdie was really funny.
Yeah,
she was. Yeah, she was really good.
And you've got to mention Marilyn Monroe's very, very short couple minutes.
It's very short, but she steals the scene.
Yes.
That's one of her first like performances too. I think that she hadn't really developed her whole persona.
Mm-hmm.
And so like that raspy voice that she's kind of known for or whatever.
Yeah.
You don't really pick it up in this one because she hadn't quite fully developed it yet.
And in reality, the character she's playing in this film doesn't fit that Marilyn Monroe stereotype.
Yeah.
Because Marilyn Monroe, if I understand her persona correctly, kind of ditzy in a way, like not super ditzy, but kind of ditzy, but she's smart in this film.
Yeah, she is smart in this film. And she was smart. I don't know if ditzy is really the right word to use for her.
It might be the wrong word.
But what she ended up becoming, I mean, she was the it girl of the 50s and into the 60s, I guess, a huge sex symbol for men and an icon for women. Like everybody wanted to be. If you go back and watch Mad Men, I mean, she's her influence on the people in that time period is really played up on that show because there's a scene in there. You know, there, if you've never seen the show there, you should. They're all advertising guys. And so they're very in tune with what they pick up from folks around the world, around the city when they're out there. And one thing they pick up on is that the women in the office are wearing their hair in one of two ways. They're either wearing it like Marilyn or they're wearing it like Jackie Kennedy.
Yeah.
And so that in turn leads to some big advertising revelation or whatever. But I mean, he's right. That's at some point in there, she's going to become this enormous pop culture icon that is one thing to women and another thing to men at that time. And, you know, it's interesting to see it here and then maybe go back and watch something that is more geared towards that particular persona that she is. Something like Some Like It Hot from the late 50s with mm-hmm. Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis. Fantastic. Also, if you've never seen it, one of the funniest movies ever made. And she really kind of is exactly, that's like her quintessential role, I think. If someone asked me what I think of when I think of Marilyn Monroe, that's the one right there.
Mm-hmm.
It's that movie.
Yeah, no, she had some great lines. My favorite one was the first one that she said. I think it was her first line when she comes in with Addison DeWitt and they're talking about, you know, hey, maybe you should sit there and talk to Addison, you know, but you know, you might just be careful not to bore him. And then she says something, oh, you're not going to bore him, honey. You won't get a word in.
Yeah.
No, really, really well done. But again, got to come back to Bette Davis and her kind of dual performance. So because a lot of movies, especially if we're talking about movies depicting that kind of duality of womanhood, especially in the 50s, the career woman, the woman that wants to be with a man, there's a lot of that back and forth, right? Where sometimes Margot is this very liberated, very powerful, very, this is me and you're not going to stop me from being who I want to be. But then later kind of this uneasiness, this insecurity about, well, I'm getting to be this age and I'm not married and things like that. Did you notice anything like that, Heather, as you watched it?
Well, yeah. I mean, and she's been, you know, independent and she's had this amazing career in the theater and, you know, and then Bill is apparently, you know, make it sound like he's been asking her to get married for a long time. And she's like, I can't. And he's like, well, you can, you just don't want to tell me why you won't. And then they just kind of cut to her and you can just see it on her face. She's like, yeah, I know. I just don't want to talk about it. Right. Like when she doesn't. And so, yeah. And then there's this point later in the movie where they do get engaged and then married. And then, you know, she stops working quite so much. She's like, hey, I have something to do now. I have someone to be with. I don't have to be working all the time, mm-hmm. you know? And I think it just kind of shows, you know, how her character evolves and changes over the course of the mm-hmm. movie. Because at one point she's like, yeah, I just got to work and work and work. And that's just what I do.
Mm-hmm.
But then once they get married, you know, she's like, well, I'm not going to do this. I have too much to do at the house is what they say later. you know, and that's just, mm-hmm. that's such a married person thing to say, right? Like, I mean, it is.
Well, and the turning point kind of comes right after they've stayed, you know, Karen has pulled that trick and stranded Margot out in the country so that Eve can play that role. Then they have that news article where Eve kind of cuts on Margot about being old. And then Bill comes mm-hmm. back. They've had that meltdown fight in the theater. Margot was upset and collapsed crying. And then Bill comes back after that article was read. And for the first time, they had this like kind of big hug, big embrace. And it's like, well, Bill's here. And that's when their relationship, I think, changed. Because mm-hmm. No matter how kind of playful their relationship had been, that was when Bill really kind of stepped in and said, you were really hurt. I'm really here for you.
Yeah. He really was.
You know, as opposed to him kind of letting her flail and thrash about when she was drunk in the party scene.
Well, and she was kind of throwing a tantrum, right? I mean, she was. Mm-hmm. She was throwing a tantrum. And, you know, you spent 20 minutes with her before you came to see me. You're so attracted to her. I mean, just no. Like,
well, and what a great script, because we're having the conversation. Eve is in the early stages of her moves, but they're mm-hmm. so well camouflaged by the fact that we're making Margot look like kind of a shrew.
Mm-hmm. A little bit, yeah.
You know, she's pitching a fit about Bill. Like you said, she's pitching a fit about Bill and Eve talking. Then she's getting drunk. And then she's, you know, basically lashing out at everything that moves.
Mm-hmm. And she does. Yeah.
I'll just say I feel a little bit attacked maybe by one little element about this movie when you talk about what the plot is.
Yeah.
And how she's described as an aging Broadway actress.
Yes.
Bette Davis was 42 when this movie came out. Is that aging?
No.
You talk
No.
I mean, they talk about like aging football players are 35, you know, and that,
right, yeah, no, weird, the 40s are ancient for that field, yeah.
And even in Hollywood too, I guess you could say that. But I mean, in 1950, I guess if you are 42, I mean your time's done. Get off the stage. We need more room for these younger kids to come up here. I mean, but she was 42 when this came out, and it was it's weird to think that you would consider that in the 1950s to be aging.
Yeah. I will say that the name of the play that she was in the film did not help her feel any better about her age. The name of the play she was starring in was called Aged in Wood.
Yeah.
And I did not understand that at all.
Right. Yeah. It's like, man, if you're trying to downplay the age, that's a terrible title.
Yeah.
That's you may as well call it Golden Girls. I mean, sheesh.
Yeah. Well, and Anne Baxter would have been... I think 27 mm-hmm. when this came out too. So, I mean, the way Hollywood works, even then 27, you're kind of like, okay, well, let's movie out, make some room for these younger people. So, mm-hmm. But,
well, and in a bit of life imitating art that did happen on the set of this movie, George Sanders, actually the guy that played Essen DeWitt, got into it with his wife because the wife was not happy about him doing scenes with Marilyn Monroe.
Well, what wife would have been happy about that?
Yeah, 100%. And apparently at the time, Betty Davis had a rep for being kind of difficult to work with. And mm-hmm. She was not difficult. In fact, she apparently praised the filming of this and the way all of it went. She and Anne Baxter apparently had a great relationship, despite the possible torpedoing of the Best Actress category.
Well, I mean, you can't say that for certain, but usually, yeah. I mean, you've seen that across somebody is not, there's two people nominated for the same movie in the same year. And it's like, how do you do it? How do you figure out which one's better than the other? The votes get split and usually goes to someone else, or
right.
You'll see that in more of the technical categories where somebody's nominated for two awards in the same category. You see that a lot for Best Score. Mm-hmm. You'll have a guy nominated for two movies, and usually when you see that, it's like, well, he's probably not winning because, you know, people are going to vote for one score, not the other one, and it's mm-hmm. easier if everybody just gets to vote for one. John Williams was nominated for many, many awards two times in the same year in the same category and would never win it. Or I remember a couple years ago, there was a composer, one of the better ones working today, and I'm going to mispronounce his name, Alexandre Desplat, maybe he's French, Desplat, he was up for two in the same year, one of which was the Grand Budapest Hotel, which is the one that I think was the better of the scores that year. And I'm like, damn, he's not going to win either of them because he's up against himself. It's just going to cancel out. And he did win. I don't remember if it was for Budapest or not, but he won for one of those. And that was great. Usually you see that where somebody, you got two actors nominated for Best Actor, Best Actress. One mm-hmm. of them is going to cancel the other one out. But mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking about movies that are 40 years old on our main series. And Amadeus, you had Tom Hulce and F. Murray Abraham nominated in the same Best Actor category, and Abraham actually wins, thankfully.
Yeah.
Tom Hulce didn't knock him out of that one, but that's because he absolutely owns that movie, and I hope we get to talk about it either here on our Best Picture series or on our normal series.
It actually happened in the same year because Celeste Holm and Thelma Ritter were both up for supporting actress.
Yep, that's true.
Same kind of situation there. So Heather, I got to tee this one up for you because I know you probably have it in your notes and are dying to talk about it. Tell me about your favorite line from this film.
Oh, absolutely. My favorite line from this movie is when they're at a party, a coming home party for Bill, after he gets back from Hollywood, and it's his birthday party. And Margot is in the middle of her meltdown and she is quite drunk, and she's going on and on about, you know, Eve and how young she is, and, you know, and her friend Karen comes over and she's like, no, but Bill, you know, Bill doesn't care, and he's only 8 years younger than you. And she just goes, Bill's 32. He looks 32. He looked at 5 years ago. He'll look at 20 years from now. I hate men.
I hate men. She says it so like slowly and just dripping with disdain.
My favorite line.
Sharp Mankiewicz writing right there.
So what was your favorite line from the film, Trevor?
Oh man, I don't even know. I'll just take the cop out and say it's a seatbelts line. There's so many good lines in that. And I mean, the writing is so well done, but I mean, that one, the one Heather just mentioned is good just because of how she delivers it too. But also the fasten your seatbelts is also delivered in that such a way. I mean, she just kind of like, she leans on the rail and just kind of looks around like, here we go.
Mm-hmm.
We're in for a night here. And it's just, it's, I don't know. She's perfect in this.
Mm-hmm. My favorite line, there's two lines I'll mention, and both of these are, I am also listening because the Ebert liked them so much. When Roger Ebert reviewed this film, he must have really loved the writing because he literally quotes it almost every paragraph. Go back to that first scene. Eve is giving that sob story, you know, lost my husband in the war, saw Margot Channing film in Margot Channing theater production in San Francisco. Thelma Ritter literally says, "What a story. Everything but the bloodhound snapping at her rear end." You know, when it's like, oh yeah, Birdie saw right through it pretty much from the start. And Margot doesn't start to see it until Birdie points it out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like she's studying you. She's learning you, you know, like that kind of stuff. But my overall favorite was when Eve is starting to make this turn and she makes a move on Bill. And, you know, she's sitting there. She's got those eyes on. Again, she's cutting her eyes at him. Very like sultry, very like, I'm right here. Let's do this. And Bill basically cuts her away with, what I go after, I want to go after. I don't want it to come after me.
Oh yeah, that was really good too.
And completely turned her away. It was really, really good. I did have one other fun fact I was going to point out to you before we move on. So funny story, the film opens with the award ceremony and they are giving out the, I think it's called the Sarah Siddons Award. So at the time, the award was a fake award, was not real.
And now it is.
After this movie, they created it. I think it looks like it was a Chicago theatrical award. The Sarah Siddons Society was legitimately founded in 1952 by theater patrons who wanted to promote excellence in theater. And they started giving a Sarah Siddons Award every year. And for the record, they still give it out. They gave one out this year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So
and it's all from this one.
Yeah. And what's funny, and I can tell you, I'm looking at the list of winners right now. It is kind of a who's who. Let's see here. Betty Davis got the award in 73. Lauren Bacall got the award. Julie Harris, Jessica Tandy, Angela Lansbury, Florence Henderson. Let's see. There's Helen Hayes. Liza Minnelli got the award. Lily Tomlin got the award. Julie Andrews, Faye Dunaway, Brian Dennehy. Kathleen Turner, who when I looked at Kathleen Turner, I actually looked it up because for a minute I thought Ian Baxter looked so much like Kathleen Turner a little bit, especially in the way she was delivering lines.
Not today.
No, not today. Kate Baldwin, and the most recent award winner was Stephanie J. Block. But it is funny to me that this movie inspired a real award that has literally been given away every year since.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, just another really good legacy.
So can we talk about maybe this would make more sense when we get to some more recent movies or whatever, but let's look and see what else was up and maybe see if the more deserving actually won.
Sure.
And like I said, this probably won't make a whole lot of sense on something this old because some of these you probably don't know because I don't know. Born Yesterday.
It's right. It's not like we can say, hey, this movie is just so much better.
Yeah.
Well, let's see.
So Born Yesterday was nominated for Best Picture. That's the one that Judy Holliday won the award for instead of Betty Davis and Ann Baxter. The original Father of the Bride, the one that Steve Martin is based on. This one was Spencer Tracy and Elizabeth Taylor.
Gonna have to watch that now. Thanks.
Directed by Vincent Minnelli, Liza's father. That was up that year. This one I've never seen before. King Solomon's Mines. Not really sure what it's about. Deborah Kerr, but I've not seen it before. And then the one that this movie gets so often compared to because they're very similar and they come out in the same year, and that Sunset Boulevard. And I almost wish that we would have done a duo on this, but I wanted to kind of keep it just for the Best Picture, just so you guys had a chance if you had never seen it, just to kind of see what that one was like, because it is very, very similar. It's about a screenwriter that comes over and tries to write a comeback for a Hollywood starlet from years earlier, but the difference is that she is quite literally like certifiably insane. So and that one also has one of the most famous lines in movie history ever, more famous than this one too. In fact, it is number 7 on the AFI list of most famous quotes of all time, and that's, "All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up." And so you've heard that in
endlessly tons quoted, of, yes,
the delivery and the moment, because that's like one of the last lines of the movie, I think. And just her delivery and where we're at in the story and what's happening in that scene and how she delivers it. It just is eerie. But that was up for Best Picture that year, too. And I think in any other year, it probably would have won. But that's really good. William Holden is in that. And then Gloria Swanson as the Norma Desmond. Really great. Billy Wilder, director. I love Billy Wilder. It's a jack of all trades when it came to movie making. The guy was great in everything in these thriller noir movies like Sunset Boulevard and Double Indemnity, and then the comedies that he did like The Apartment. So
Well, and Billy Wilder and William Holden would both factor into one of my favorite old movies of all time, Stalag 17.
Yes. I knew you were gonna say that.
Completely love that movie, not to mention William Holden's shortest acceptance speech of all time.
Yeah,
well, basically he got the award, walked up, said thank you, and walked off stage.
Yeah. So very William Holden.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great, great movie too.
Oh, my dad made me watch that movie, and it is still to me one of the most convincing whodunits I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Like, I used to show that film in my history class, and one year I got so bold, I offered my kids a free test 100 if at a certain point in the movie they could name the snitch. No one ever won. No one ever got it right.
No.
And the one kid that did get it right admitted that he looked it up the day before at work.
Uh-huh.
Nice.
It's very not who you'd expect in that, for sure.
Definitely.
So.
Well, what about some of the other awards? Because, you know, George Sanders won for All About Eve. The other nominees there, Jeff Chandler for Broken Arrow, Edmund Gwenn for Mr. 880, mm-hmm. Sam Jaffe for The Asphalt Jungle, and Eric Von Stroheim for Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah, so that one I'm very familiar with. He's really good in that too. And honestly, the only other one I'm familiar with is The Asphalt Jungle.
Mm-hmm.
But no, George Sanders gets this one every time. So that's good. This is actually one of the only movies ever that has nominations in every single acting category.
They did not have a nomination for Best Actor, though.
Yes, they did. No, they didn't. You're right. Dang.
The winner that year was Jose Ferrer for Cyrano de Bergerac, Louis Calhern for The Magnificent Yankee, William Holden for Sunset Boulevard, Jimmy Stewart for Harvey, and Spencer Tracy for Father of the Bride. That's a pretty loaded Best Actor class,
yeah.
Too.
Dang, man. Oh, I'm thinking, I'm confusing the two again because they're so similar. It's Sunset Boulevard is the one that has acting nominations in every category.
Right.
So there, I get confused on that one.
Yeah. Alongside Baxter and Davis. And as you'd mentioned, Judy Holliday, who won. Supporting actress was won by Josephine Hull for Harvey. And then Hope Emerson for Caged, Celeste Holm and Thelma Ritter from All About Eve, and Nancy Olsen from Sunset Boulevard. So kind of a Barbieheimer situation, right? Like two films going at it for awards.
Yeah. I think it was 14 for All About Eve and 11 for Sunset Boulevard.
Wow.
Yeah. You guys should really watch that. And I wish maybe we probably should have watched that as well, just so you could have some background on it. But,
So coming 2025, films that didn't win and should have. We'll be like the other movie from that year.
First up, Citizen Kane and Sunset Boulevard.
See, the content is writing itself.
It is writing itself.
Fun also thing to point out, apparently on the set of this film, Betty Davis fell in love with Gary Merrill. They got married and were married for 10 years after this film came out.
How about that?
Only to divorce under what sounded like the terms of, it sounds like Gary Merrill fell in love with Margot Channing instead of Betty Davis.
That, I think, is usually what happens in Hollywood when you see these two people kind of get together. It's like, are you really falling in love, or did the fact that you were like looking at each other and you were both acting in love? And,
did the chemistry take another level? Because that's happened, right?
Yeah,
sure.
Ben Affleck and Jennifer Garner worked together, got married. Gosh, we could talk about that. There's tons of those stories.
And like some of them you want to be real too. And doesn't work that way. You know, everyone loved Jim and Pam from The Office, and they really wanted that to be real in real life. And like you'd bring it up to those two and they'd be like, no.
Right. They kind of joke about it, right? It's like that. It's literally a workplace thing for them.
Yeah, that's all it is.
And then you realize that John Krasinski and Emily Blunt are endlessly cute together, and it's like, yeah, cool.
Oh, yeah. Or you're watching the Golden Globes, and like John Krasinski gets to sit at the Oppenheimer table because his wife's nominated, and he actually had the dead center seat. Like every single acceptance speech, it's like, if I was there and I won that night for something, I'd be like holding that Golden Globe, be like, I cannot give this speech with Jim Halpert looking at me right now.
Right? Because well, you know there's a producer, because you know there's multiple cameras on that, right? There's a guy with a camera on John Krasinski, literally like in the head of production's booth going, he's going to make the face. He's going to make the face. I know he's going to do it. So obviously we're looking at a film from the 50s. You know, you mentioned that kind of haze rule, the kind of haze code, all the things you can't have. Apparently one thing you absolutely could have in a movie was smoking, because good God, everybody smokes.
Well, everyone smoked in the 50s anyway, but Betty Davis, that was kind of her thing, was like, she always had a cigarette on her.
Well, and Eve eventually lights one up too, but it's at the very end when Phoebe comes into the picture.
It was
when she gets to, by the way, how casual is Eve about that? Like,
someone being in her apartment when she gets home.
Yeah. Like at least when Eve enters the picture with Margot Channing, Karen walks her in, and like, she comes in, Eve comes in and the woman is asleep in her room.
And she's like,
Okay. Hey, what are you doing here?
She's probably like, I got a fan. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right? True.
You're like, I
that's
have arrived. Point.
So can we just talk about Addison DeWitt's character for a minute?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I was asking Scotty this in the scene where he basically outs her and says, you know, I know your whole story is a lie. This is not even your real name. Your parents miss you, by the way. So in this whole thing, like, what does Addison DeWitt get out of telling her, like, you will be owned by me. Like, you will not marry anyone else. I will forbid it. And you will listen to everything I say. Like, what mm-hmm. does he get out of this?
Could that be kind of like when the villain spills all the details about his diabolical plan before he thinks he's going to kill the bad guy, but the bad or the good guy, but the good guy ends up making it out?
Yeah. Well, and, you know, we've gushed in this episode about the intentionality of the script and the writing. Why doesn't the writing veer into the romantic? Because it kind of doesn't, you know, like he brings it like you're going to like whenever the romance is brought up, like romance is a subtext, but he also basically talks about her like a possession. You're going to be mine.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's kind of creepy, actually.
I don't know. Because I did point out, it could just easily be, I'm going to use you as a professional contact. The higher you go in the ranks, you're going to be my mole.
Yeah. If I want an interview with this actress or that director, you're going to make sure it happens because I have all this dirt on you and I know who you really are.
Mm-hmm.
Was it Addison DeWitt? Yeah. Isn't he like, he's a writer, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a critic.
He's a newspaper critic. Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe this is his way of kind of like, because all critics want to be a part of it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's why they all hang around of it. I want to make movies too, you know?
Like, well, the movie is so meta that way, you know? Like,
he's sitting there like, I can make my own movie by controlling you, and then you'll just be my pawn in the newspaper every time I write something.
Well, and nice. Part of the dialogue in the, I mean, you go back to the dialogue that opens the film, Addison's dialogue to open the film.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he described modern movie making in part of that line. You know, there are two types of directors, one who isn't afraid to take risks and one who wants to make money.
Yeah, that's modern. All right.
It was like,
I think most
man.
Of them are all about the money right now.
Right. Yeah. No, it's, you know, there's somebody not afraid to take risks to make money, but very, very meta. Right. Like there's a lot of film jokes. There's a famous Hollywood guest that shows up to the party with this gaudy jacket or this gaudy like fur coat that all the ladies go nuts over. And we don't get the person's name, but they kind of joke. And there's a couple of TV jokes. Addison DeWitt makes a TV joke to Marilyn Monroe. She says something like, you know, is there auditions for TV? And he's like, well, man, that's all it is with TV auditions.
Yep.
That's it.
Like there's just so much smart humor around the industry. Like it feels like the kind of movie that would have probably made a lot of industry folks kind of laugh about some of the jokes they made, kind of the in jokes and kind of elbow bumps about the industry.
Well, and Hollywood loves movies about themselves. So anything that they can do to be like, huh, I know that. I know what that means. or pat themselves on the back in any way. If you ever want to know what's going to win an Oscar any year, just look, is it about a movie? Is it a movie about a movie? Is it a movie about a play? Yeah, it's going to win.
One more quick note on, you know, one of my geeky notes. So Edith Head did the costume design for this film. She and Charles Lemaire won the Oscar for best costume design for this film. Since we did point out the other categories, she beat out Jean-Louis for Born Yesterday and Walter Plunkett for The Magnificent Yankee. Those are the two other people they beat out for this award. So apparently the dress, I guess it was the dress that Margot wore at the cocktail party at her place for the birthday party. She had that off the shoulder look where the dress was hanging off the shoulders. So apparently that was not on purpose because Edith had ordered a dress for her, for Betty Davis. And when the dress arrived, it didn't fit.
Oh.
And so apparently the dress didn't fit. And in the panic of getting a dress, Betty Davis came up with the idea to just wear it off the shoulders. And I'm not well-versed enough in fashion history, but as I understood it, it's one of those things where if Betty Davis did it, lots of people wanted to do it after her.
And so women started walking around in the 1950s showing their shoulders. Makes sense.
It's scandalous.
Like I said, just like, you know, you're either a Marilyn or a Jackie in the 1960s.
Right, right. And they just start following the trend. So what should be our takeaway for the way we look at movies today from All About Eve? Like, what should All About Eve teach us about what to look for in movies in 2024?
You should match your script up against this movie, and if it doesn't come anywhere near it, then you throw it away. Start over.
Yeah, no, I'm going to agree with that because it almost made me wonder, like, have we just gotten dumber? Right? Like the joke that's made about Margot Channing being old is, you know, I have long denied the rumor that you were in the theater the night Our American Cousin was playing or something. They made a joke about a play that at that point was almost 100 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just, like I said, it makes me wonder, like, the romantic comedies nowadays, the writing is, I can't think of a romantic comedy that matches up to it in terms of how smart the writing was. Mm-mm. Not in my modern memory anyway.
No, I can't either.
Well, and there's not many better written movies out there. I mean, just in general. I mean, you could use that Writers Guild list as a template, I guess, and match it up against that. But, you know, even not, like, there's not many better written movies out there. I mean, we've already talked about Citizen Kane. That's one of them. I've mentioned Chinatown before, maybe not on the podcast, but just in general, of how that one is probably the best screenplay ever written. And this one's certainly right up there, right near the top. So are we getting dumber? Yeah, maybe. I mentioned that modern audiences. So I might be insulting two of our three listeners, or three of our four listeners, or all of them. I don't think that, I mean, you just look at this stuff. I mean, I'm not gonna, God, I could get started and go all night on this. So I won't, but
I'm looking at that 101 greatest screenplays list since you mentioned that. Like, I'm looking at, like, what is the most modern film that's the highest?
Mm-hmm.
From what I can see, there's Pulp Fiction right there at 16, and Shawshank Redemption at 22. Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, probably the newest one at 24, is my guess based on that. Cause then you've got Double Indemnity, Wizard of Oz, Groundhog Day. I don't know. It's just an interesting question.
Yeah. And they redid that list again a couple of years later, where they looked at the best screenplays of the 21st century, and number one on that is Get Out.
Oh, wow. I thought about that. So Heather, what is All About Eve make you look for in movies in 2024?
Better dialogue. Honestly. Yeah. I mean, it's like, I actually appreciate, like, well-written dialogue with lots of quips back and forth, and that's witty, and this movie had all of that.
Yeah, lots of quips, especially in some of those fights.
Yeah, oh yeah, they were slinging them at each other, and it was great. Yeah. It was
Margot and Lloyd's fight, Margot and Bill's fight right there in the theater. Lots of back and forth, so much back and forth.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, I love that in a movie. I appreciate things that are written like that. So that's what I'm after.
Also, something that I think would have been pretty meta for the time, right? Lloyd gets real mad at Margot and yells, "It's time for the piano to realize it did not write the concerto."
God, that's what a great line.
Well, guys, any closing thoughts on All About Eve?
My only thought is I'm glad we're doing this, because, I mean, would you guys have ever stumbled across this movie?
No,
I don't think so. And I'm actually really excited to watch some of these older films that I've never even heard of. Yeah. Right. Because, I mean, you know, like we said, this one came out 34 years before I was even born.
Yeah.
So why would I stop and be like, you know, I need to see that. But I loved this movie. I really, really enjoyed it. And I'm glad that we're taking the time to check some of these out.
I'm too. This gives a really good appreciation on where the art form is gone. You know, like, you look at movies now, and if that's all you knew, then you don't know where they came from. So this is nice to go back to, like, I mean, films at this point were only 30 or 40 years old. Like, and then especially if you add sound, they're even younger than that. So it's like, this is really where folks were kind of cutting their teeth on it and coming up with new things, coming up with new ways to write, and coming up with new ways to tell a story, coming up with new ways to film it. And nowadays we just sort of take it for granted, because, you know, it's so rare to see a actually well-written movie. You know, and then you go see these superhero movies that are just noise, and the dialogue is only used to kind of fill in between set pieces. I hate that there's like a word for that, like a set piece is some huge action sequence. And I don't, like I said, we could go for hours talking about my disdain for some of this stuff. Not knocking all of them. There's been some good movies like that, but no, I'm just, they're not for me anymore. I don't need to just watch a commercial, because that's all they are. We're just a bridge to the next one. I watch these Marvel movies, and it's like, it's just, I'm doing homework so I can catch up to know what's coming next, you know?
Right.
Like,
I don't think they're shifting out of, but
I don't even want to go see any of these ones that are coming out in theaters this last year, because it's like, I didn't see the 12 Disney Plus episodes.
I saw the Aquaman sequel, and I thought it was good, you know, but it's kind of sad, because the movie was kind of a zombie movie to begin with.
Yeah, but what did you get out of it? And did you forgot about it as soon as you walked out of the theater, probably, and by the time you got home, it was just sort of like, okay, well, what next, you know?
Yeah,
but this movie sit with you, this one that we just watched?
Oh, 100%.
Like, and you're gonna remember it for a while, because it actually has some substance to it.
Yeah,
like, I picked up the phone and called my dad, and I was like, Dad, you're never gonna believe what we watched for our podcast. This movie was amazing, and you have to see it.
Had he seen it?
He had not.
Yeah,
he was telling his wife about it, and his wife was like, we have that on DVD.
Awesome.
So I told him, I was like, you have to sit down and watch this.
You know, that means at some point 20 years from now, one of our children is going to send us like a text message or call us and say, hey, have you seen this really old movie, Back to the Future? Have you seen that? We're about to, you know, I can see Trevor's kid right now. Dad, I just saw this amazing movie. It changed my life. It's called The Matrix.
Oh, geez.
Oh, yeah.
Don't give me nightmares already on that.
Trevor wakes up in a cold sweat. No.
Yeah, no. We're watching All About Eve now. Let's show you what a real movie is.
There you go.
Well, folks, that is all it for All About Eve, but I guess we get to, well, we got to take care of what our next film is going to be in our sequence here. So I guess, Heather, can you give us the, can you give Trevor the random number so we can pull our next film?
So we got, you know, this was 23, right? So if you want to go newer, you know where to go. But if you want to go older, you know where to
go. See, and the first one I picked, I didn't even have a clue what I was picking a number for. Scotty was just like, hey, honey, pick a number between 1 and 95. And I was like, okay. 23. All right. Let's see. I'm going to go with, let's go backwards. Let's go 17.
Oh, all right. So we're going older than 1950. That's cool. The 17th Annual Academy Awards was in 1945 for the 1944 year in film. And the best picture winner that year is Going My Way, with Bing Crosby. It, actually, I just watched this movie for the first time within the last 6 months. It had to have been maybe six or 7 months. And I think it was when I was watching these that I got this idea that we needed to do this because I don't have anybody I could talk to these movies about these movies to. And I was like, this was so good. And I can't, like, if you ever see Going My Way, like, what the hell is that? You know,
like, not a great conversation starter at work.
No,
huh?
it's not at all. And so that was sort of that one. And another one from the same time period too, was kind of what gave me this idea. So this one I've seen, and I've seen really recently, but I'll watch it again so we can talk about it. But it's also a really good movie, and it features one of, I think, Bing Crosby's more famous songs that he's ever written, which is called
My Way.
So that'll be good. I like that movie a lot. There's a fun little Academy distinction about that one, which I'll bring up when we record it.
All righty. Well, there you have it, folks. Bing Crosby, Going My Way. So hopefully you'll be going our way for that next episode coming out sometime in the near future, along with our next episode about Speed. So we've got a good few things happening in the Rearview Movies multiverse of film, as it is. I guess we're officially a multiverse now, since we're spanning different, completely different eras of film, but please
don't
do continue
use that word in don't my use presence. Okay.
Folks, join us again next time when we get the chance to look at an old film with new eyes.